Russian goat. I am E. Christopher Clark, and with me, as always, is John Martin of Shh, Listen.
Hi, how's it going?
Hey, shh, listen to this. Wow. Our website anniversary, you just told me this just before we started recording. Our podcast anniversary was yesterday.
Yesterday, and you didn't get me anything.
I know. Thanks. Now you know what Stephanie feels like every year.
God damn. 222.09, man.
Yeah, so 3 years.
3 years, and this is like, I mean, really, if you add up the half episodes, this is like our 26th. Numerically, it's 27.
It's 27, which means that that our podcast is about to commit suicide, right?
Well, or it will have an untimely death.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, you know, we could...
It could be an overdose.
Put a bullet in our brain, or we could, you know, choke on a ham sandwich.
Like, yeah.
It's one or the other.
There are a few different options. Yeah, wow, weird. So episode 27.
27. Over... Which means that if we make it through this podcast alive, we'll never be cool.
Wait a minute. Implies that we were cool to begin with.
Well, it just means that we'll have no hope of attaining coolness.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm all right with that.
Yeah, I don't know. Kind of hoping Ricola swells up a little bit.
Yeah, you know, and then you'll be known forever as podcaster who died of cough drop.
That's right.
You know, that's right. Hey, that's a pretty good way to go as deaths go, I think.
You know, actually, thinking of the 27th thing, like 2 days ago, yeah, 2 days ago now would have been Kurt Cobain's 45th birthday, which is just crazy.
That's very odd to think about him at that age. I mean, I
like to think of me at this age.
I can't imagine a 45-year-old Kurt Cobain. And I mean, maybe if he not died, I could, but it's hard to, there are certain people it's hard to imagine them any older than they were when they died. I don't know. I can almost imagine, you know, how old would he be now? How old would Lennon be now if he hadn't died? 1940 was he born? Or was it earlier than that?
I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
72.
So 72. I mean, I can almost picture an old John Lennon, you know, but an old Kurt Cobain, I can't. It's hard to wrap my head around.
Certainly it would be true that an old John Lennon would be easier in the eyes than an old Paul McCartney. God damn. Have you seen him lately?
I mean, speaking of, you know, last week we talked about, I hope that poor old lady doesn't break her hip. I mean,
yeah.
You know, Sir Paul, not looking so good.
Well, you know, at a certain point, you just got to hang up the whole, like, I am America or Britain's, you know, most awkward parent. And, you know, just go away. Please.
Yeah. There was a clip. I don't know if he played. It sounds like at the Grammys he played a full medley from Abbey Road. But the clip that showed up online was literally just a bunch of guys stroking it on their guitars. Like,
yeah.
You know, Joe Walsh was there and Dave Grohl and just every sort of, I don't know, Paul worshiper that you could possibly think of.
You know, this is really, we're just all over the place, but I mean, just like, as hard as it is to picture a 45-year-old Kurt, like, I kind of wish I couldn't picture a 45-year-old David Grohl. I mean,
yeah.
You hate to use the word sellout, but when you're.
But,
yeah.
If that's the word, if that's, you know, that's
I
what
mean,
you
look,
got.
I like the Foo Fighters, kind of, but.
There are some strong Foo Fighters songs, for sure, but they are getting fewer and farther between. Farther. Yeah.
Actually, I think actually the thing that was hard for me to get into the Foos was the continued presence of Pat Smear.
Mm.
I just can't look at him. Like, I physically cannot look at him. I feel uncomfortable looking at him.
I agree. I think it was post-Pat Smear and pre-Pat Smear that... that I adored the Foo Fighters. There's like two or three albums in the middle there where he wasn't around, and I found those to be pretty good. Yeah. Although there are a couple of songs on the, I don't know if it's the second or the third record that that I really like. And of course, the first record is pretty darn good itself. But I think it's the color and the shape was the first one that that I really liked. And I'm sure Pat Smear might have been around for that, but I don't.
I just don't have to look at the guy. I mean, look, you know, this is an audio podcast for a reason. Nobody wants to have to look at me. I'm just aesthetically, I just can't do it.
Nobody would want to look at me right now because a Skype is blowing up my head.
Well, you're all dirty from working in the salt mine today.
Yes, it's the salt mine. Yes, today was the salt mine, and it was a rough day down there. You know,
I don't know how you do it. You have all these different things going. Like, what was it yesterday? You were like traveling around in a covered wagon fixing pots or something.
Well, yeah, and then there was, you know, we had to take the covered wagon across the river, and we were going.
Please tell me you didn't caulk and float that thing.
I tried the caulk
and
float.
Idiot.
I'm sorry.
And how many bullets did you lose?
I lost about 62.
What about Little Disco? Did Little Disco make it across the river?
Little Disco, no. Little Disco,
peace.
It did not make it. And we lost one of the cows.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oxen. Yes. Damn it.
Yeah, it was.
The game, it drove me crazy. I was super good at hunting. I would shoot like 900 pounds of meat and be like, take that, nature.
Right.
And it would be like, oh, but you can only carry 100, dude. Like, can't we make two trips? I mean,
yeah.
I know we're going across the country, but there's six of us right now. And are we really, like, do we have to get to Wally World on time? Like, what the hell, guys?
Yeah,
all that was gone to waste.
I was good at it to a certain extent, as good as I was at any video games. It was one of the ones that you played when the like four or five computers got trucked around between the classrooms over at Westlands Elementary School. And then I didn't really play it again until I got my very first computer of my own, good old Pentium 166 with MMX technology.
Nice. In case, you know, we should say we're talking about the Oregon Trail.
The Oregon Trail. In case it wasn't.
At least for the benefit of my girlfriend, who never knows any cultural, historical reference.
Right, yeah. Oregon Trail. And I played a version of it on that first Windows machine. It was that and Quake. I went back and forth between. Those were the two games I had on the computer.
You know, it occurred to me yesterday, and I really should check the date on this, but I think Doom should be 20 this year or next year. You know, Wikipedia. Are you still there?
Gosh.
Oh, there you are.
I'm still here, yeah.
See, what you can't see at home, people, is that Chris's gigantic head is filling up this little window over here because next year, Doom came out next year. Okay, so yeah. I'm not so old. Yeah, occasionally it freezes. So this will be an awkward podcast. I'm going, dude.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's I have a big head. I have a big head that's hard to fit into a room. It's you know, the result of too much success. It's going to my head. That's the expression, right?
Fair enough. Now the best part too is it's turned into like a Japanese movie, and Chris's face and his sound are like 20 seconds out.
The same thing is happening with John's sound over on this end, so I'm not sure. It's very amusing to watch.
What Chris probably doesn't realize is that his computer is just busy doing something.
I thought I'd turned everything off. I'm gonna check because it looks like everything should be off, but yeah.
That's okay. It's only hugely distracting, so I think we're
well. You know, it is hugely distracting. But, you know, it is what it is. I have an older computer. It's, you know. There's
only so much we can do. And this is riveting podcasting.
It is. Yeah, we'll cut all this out.
We always say that and we never do.
Well, you know, that's the thing about most of the podcasts I listen to. They say, we'll cut all this out. And they don't, as if it's a running joke. You know, we'll cut all this out.
For ours, it's just half-assery.
It's a struggle to get through it once, you know, so I'm just trying to get through it and make sure the levels are all right. And then by the second time, I'm like, I don't want to cut anything, you know, whatever.
Lazy bastard.
Yeah.
Once again, need interns. So, okay. So last week. Wow.
Last week.
Last week.
See, that was the other thing I was going to check on the website. Has it ever happened back-to-back weeks? Now, it probably has with some of those episodes where we did a prelude to PodCamp, and then PodCamp happened. But I was trying to think of, were there any back-to-back episodes featuring both of us?
I don't know.
And if my computer weren't so slow, I'd go over and look.
Well, it's interesting that one of us is going to die that during this podcast. So.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah.
Nice.
No, so, yes, true. Last
been,
week.
Yeah, it's been a while since that even came close. And where was I going with that? Oh, right. Last week, you mentioned you had a play, and I didn't go because, frankly, I don't care for that sort of thing. But how'd it go, man?
It went really well. It was Crossroads, or The Piano of Death was the title of it.
Walk us through that title.
I what?
Why don't you just walk us through that title?
Walk through the title. Well, so the whole project began. My college classmate, Crystal Lisbon, wrote me an email, and she was starting an arts company, sort of a cross arts. So a little bit of dance, a little bit of theater, a little bit of music. And she wanted to do an initial benefit performance to help raise money for, you know, an eventual full-scale performance. And she said, you know, when I thought of a script, Chris, you were the first person I thought of. So she and I and a musician friend of hers, Mary Cassiello, got together at a coffee shop in Cambridge and started talking about what the hell we might do as a collaboration, and got off track pretty quickly, I imagine, I remember. And we got to talking about this intersection between adulthood and creativity, and where you're kind of forced to make a decision to be responsible or to continue doing the stuff that you love. And this had already kind of been something for me because I have the kids. And I have the jobs, salt mine and teaching and all that. And it's becoming an issue, or will be soon an issue, for Mary, who's pregnant with her first kid. And so she's out there touring as a musician. But now she's going to have to make some sacrifices. But the whole question became, do you have to make the sacrifices, or are there ways to make it work? So the Crossroads part comes from that. And then somewhere in the conversation, we had this mention of the quote-unquote piano of death, or the instrument of death. And they challenged me jokingly to write a play about that. And so I went back to the...
Yeah, well, wasn't the instrument of death in Guns N' Roses for a while?
Mm.
Wait. No, sorry, carry on.
I went back to the well I often go back to, which is this novel I've been working on for 15 years in one form or another, and started writing about this character, Veronica, who's had similar struggles in the novel. And I put her into a kind of Christmas Carol / It's a Wonderful Life mashup, where she was forced to confront scenes from her past, including... this piano of death. That's where the second part of the title comes from.
Cool. So how'd it go?
It went well. You know, there was nobody in the audience that I knew. but that
it's
was...
It's good that sentence had a second half, though.
yes. But that was what was really intriguing about it. The first time we'd done it up in the parking lot in New Hampshire, where I'm banned from doing theater, as we talked about last week.
Hey, it's your own fault, man.
Yeah.
There are some things you can do during Christmas Carol and get away with it, but...
And there are some things you can't.
It was unsavory.
I understand. No, I understand.
Gravy should not be used in that way.
No. So back up there in New Hampshire, I had most of the people in the audience were people that I knew. And so that was one kind of experience. And then this performance down in Cambridge, everyone was somebody that I did not know.
Cool.
And so
did
to be in there.
Entertained?
They did. They seemed entertained. Not nearly as many of them came up to me and said things to me afterwards.
Did you get real angry at them for that? Did you?
No, I mean they were there supporting their friends or family members in the cast, in the crew, you know, the few that did come up to me, you know, had nice things to say. So it was a nice performance. There was a different act. There are three parts, and there were, the two female parts were both played by the same actresses each time, but the male part was played by a different guy each time. And what was really interesting was to see their different takes that these guys had on the character, and on a character, and to see all of their takes on characters that I've been writing for more than a decade.
Yeah.
So it was really inspiring, and it kind of made me want to write more, which led to me going to the Players Ring the other night to pitch it as a show for their upcoming season. So
how'd it go?
I think it went all right, except that I neglected to say anything about the plot.
Yeah.
I mentioned the logistics. I mentioned where I had been playing, who had been involved, and then forgot to summarize it. Now, my understanding is that they base most of their decision on a read-through of the script.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably not as big an issue. And what they really want to see in the pitch is the passion for the project. But yeah, I probably could have stood to, I mean, it's not like I was rushed for time. I had plenty more time to work with.
I've done that. You know, you have something you're working on for so long, and like you finally get to the moment where you have to deliver it, and you just focus so much on like making the presentation go well and making sure everybody feels cool about it that you just, yeah, you totally whiff on the like, oh, and this is what it is.
Yeah.
There
were certainly some stellar pitches, and then a lot of what?
Well, you said that like people who, you know, like sleep in park benches and things just kind of come in to keep warm, and
that's the impression that I've got. There was at least one guy where I wasn't sure if he was, you know, coming straight off the street, and he, this guy that I'm thinking of, had done something on Van Gogh, and he did this very passionately delivered monologue from the show he was pitching, but he got up when someone else was called, someone with a similar name, but when someone else was called, and seemed a little disoriented. But you sort of pulled for the guy because he seemed to be very passionate about what he was doing. Then there were other people who seemed to take themselves way too seriously, just 100 times too seriously, not be having any fun with it. I understand taking yourself seriously and giving a good pitch, you know, and a professional pitch that shows passion and maybe actually describes the plot. I understand that, but some people were so serious about it that it just looked like, are you having any fun at all?
Were there a lot of mock turtlenecks going on?
Mock turtlenecks and the like. Yeah, there were some things going on there fashion-wise that, yeah. Now, it'll be interesting. Within the next couple of months, I'll find out whether or not that's going to happen. I pitched it to them basically saying, you know, this could, as is, function in their late night summer series, which is short, usually not much more than an hour long things. Or if they give me the chance to expand it, it could be a full show during the regular season. And that's kind of where I'd like to go, because February 2013 will mark the 15-year anniversary of the first time I wrote that character, Veronica, in A Lick and a Promise.
Wow.
That's
the first stage appearance of Billy Mills.
It was the first, yes, Billy Mills, whose name got changed to Ken Mills by an actress who heard the true story behind the play and was not going to let it go.
Yeah.
Ken has said to me in conversations since then that he won't come to see anything I do or read anything that I write unless it involves Billy Mills.
Well, fair enough. It's good that he gets bored about it. Hopefully, he still gets bored about the fact that there's audio of that performance where you can actually hear me in the audience going, "You suck, dude."
Yes, that audio is not online anywhere, but it could be.
It could be.
It could be. It's on my computer.
I'm not too proud of it.
That's all right. I remember that night. So this was a performance of my play, A Lick and a Promise, back in 1998, and at the late, great Bradford College. And I was directing, and that was my only involvement. And so when the play went on, I went into one of the back hallways, waiting for that moment, knowing it was coming, and wondering if the actress would say Billy Mills, which is what it was scripted, or say Ken Mills, which Ken was the inspiration for the line for the character. And when she said Ken Mills, my heart just started thudding, and I expected, I half expected him to get out of his seat and come find me. I knew Ken. I'd known him for years. I don't know why I anticipated that would be his reaction, but I was scared. I didn't want her to do that.
In 98, too, it would have been harder for you to outrun Ken. So
yes, yeah. I was not quite Ken size, but I was getting there.
Yeah, that would have been interesting. I would have put money on that. I would have picked you.
You would have? Oh, thanks,
yeah,
dude.
Yeah, I would have picked you.
Thank you.
Just a little bit. I don't think I would have gotten more than 2-1. But
yeah, no, you would have been careless better if you were doing more than 2-1. I think.
Anyway, you know, it's funny. Like, just thinking about like the stuff we've talked about so far, and you know, it seems like for a lot, and it's not just us. I mean, it's just like a lot of people. Like, there's this moment where, I don't know, sort of just after high school or just in high school, or for a lot of people, you know, that decade that like becomes the kind of focus for so much of what you do in the next 2 decades, which is a weird thing when you think about it, because when I was 16, crap that I did when I was 6 certainly wasn't the focus of my day.
Yeah.
You know, none of my creative projects revolved around, you know, what I was up to at 7.
Right.
And I wonder, you know, if we ever, I mean, because I wonder if I'll ever have another period in my life that'll do the same function, you know, that will, is yet to come or has just come, or, because it's a little weird, you know, like, I wonder sometimes if it's healthy to have that kind of nostalgia, but then I realize I just can't help it. So, I don't know.
Well,
sorry, it's kind of a tangent, but.
No, no. I mean, it's, we started off the show, you know, kind of half joking about the 27 thing, episode 27, and, you know, rock stars who meet their end in that year of their life. The other
this
day,
is probably just going to be our jump street. Sorry.
The other day I watched a video. I think it's Elizabeth Gilbert is the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, among other things. And she was talking about genius. It was a TED talk. And she was talking about the fact that 19th, 20th century, maybe even prior to that, we've seen a lot of artists die young because of pressure, especially pressure to replicate success. When they have one great success, they're not sure how to follow it up, and the pressure is on them because they've been dubbed geniuses, rather than the sort of older way of thinking of things, of genius being something that sort of visits you and you are the conduit for.
Yeah.
And she so proposes this kind of, for lack of a better way of putting it, hippie way of looking at things, as opposed to a sort of more practical, pragmatic way of looking at creativity, where her end result, or her desired end result, is to make people feel a little bit less pressure to replicate success. And I think that might tie into this idea of feeling less pressure to replicate meaningful decades or meaningful 5-year, 4-year, 3-year periods of our life. I mean, I think it's only really in hindsight that certain periods of life seem so important anyway. Maybe there were times during high school, college, where I realized it was that important. But
Well, I mean, there's a lot of important stuff that happens, right? Like, there's a lot of firsts in people's lives in that kind of, 5, 10 year period. And fair enough. Like, those become kind of benchmarks. And I guess maybe, like, for me, I started thinking about this because, I just, for better or worse, have finished my PhD, which was a 5-ish year chunk of my life. But when you add all of the time from when I started my undergraduate to when I finished, it's 12 years. I mean, well, 11 and three quarters, and that's a long time. That's more than a third of my life. And it's weird because it's kind of like getting out of prison. Like, I finished this thing and now it's like, what do I do? I feel like the old guy Brooks in, Shawshank, where just kind of like, now what?
Now what?
And it's weird, I have this perpetual feeling of, oh, I gotta do stuff. Like, even right now, I'm sitting here, I'm enjoying our podcast, and something in my brain is like, dude, you gotta be working. What are you doing? You should be podcasting. You need to work. And I'm like, no, I don't actually. I don't have work today, and I'm okay. It's the weirdest feeling, but I guess there's sort of, this anxiety of like, well, what can I do with my time now to actually make my life purposeful and useful and good while I'm waiting for the next thing to happen? And then, there's that worry of like, well, if I'm waiting for the next thing to happen, is that how people get old without realizing it? Do you have to make the next thing happen, or does the next thing just happen?
Well, I mean, I think you're onto something there, because I think too often in my own life I've had that feeling of feeling like I'm waiting for something to happen to me rather than going out and trying to make something happen.
He's the Colin Hay. Sorry.
Yes. Where is that Colin? Mr. Hay? Mr. Hay, I wonder if he's ever been called that. Mr. Hay. Must have been by somebody at like a hotel desk or something, you know.
Certainly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hay. You'll be in room 328.
Hey, Mr. Hay.
Hey.
Yeah, anyway.
Oh, that's clever, sir.
I've never heard that before.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a balance between always pushing for what the next thing is, and between giving yourself a breather and a break, and not expecting every waking moment to be productive and moving towards something. I don't know what that balance is. I don't know how to find that balance. That's been one of the big challenges of my life. I'm either way too busy or not doing anything at all, and it seems like there's no middle ground.
Thinking about the TED Talk, actually, like, I think that a lot of the anxiety comes exactly from the idea of like, I spend a lot of time thinking to myself, I'm 33. This is what I'll, so many people I know have done by this point. This is what I've done. And I don't feel like, in so many dumb categories, like, well, gee, I don't have a house and I don't have a family, and all these things where you're like, well, they're not meaningful measures of your humanity. They're things that you do because you want to do them and because they make you happy and they make sense to you. But at the same time, it's weird when everyone you know is married or has kids or is, in the middle of a career, and you're just like, I'm gonna get up at noon today. I think I'm gonna eat some crunch berries, maybe watch some D&D cartoon, and podcast a little bit, but then I'm gonna take a nap because that's just fucking exhausting, and I don't have time for that. It's a little sad. So I think actually though that part, there's this kind of like vague sense of like, at my age, people should have done the following things, and I haven't. And I'm trying to just accept that and say, well, there are good reasons, like you chose to do a PhD. But it doesn't feel good. Yeah. It just feels like, well, you're supposed to do the PhD and the other stuff, and that's stupid.
Yeah. Well, it stupid is.
Hang on, I'm gonna lay down on this couch while we're doing this.
Okay. Yeah. it is being hard on yourself like that is probably not the best thing. I mean, but we do it anyway. I don't know how to get around it. I can't say don't be hard on yourself.
I don't know how to not do it.
Yeah.
I've tried. Like I purposely tried to be like, hey man, whatever happens, happens. And then like pretend I'm in Vermont or something. And I just can't do it for more than like an hour before I'm like, oh, I've wasted a whole hour not caring what happens.
Yeah. I read a book on Buddhism last year, that for a couple of months, during the time that I was very slowly reading it, and then for a couple months after, really did affect the way that I thought of things and approached things. And I mean, to be honest, it probably did help out in terms of long term, because I feel like the second half of last year into the beginning of this year has been one of my most productive times. But, you know, the further and further I get away from having read that book, the less and less I'm able to remember things like, you know, I couldn't even tell you what it was I learned in that book now at this point.
You're right. But let's move to Tibet.
Yeah, I think that would – I think there's a big market for pop culture podcasts in Tibet. I think
it'll be more authentic. There'll be goats.
There's an – there. Yes. There are goats around here. Just go to petting zoos.
It's a lot of yak milk, actually, in Tibet. But who cares? Let's do it anyway.
Yeah, you know, we can climb Everest while we're there.
Well, it's in Nepal, but yeah.
Hey, you know. Sure.
It'll be fantastic. We could get jobs as Sherpas.
We could. That my kids wouldn't mind playing with the goats.
No, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Generation Yak.
Generation Yak. That's, you know, I mean, it's a, you would think that's actually almost a more apropos title, you know, because we do talk.
That's right. There'll be all those awful yakking puns.
Yakking. Huh? Right? Yak.
Uh-huh. We're going to yak.
I mean, yakety yak and not talk back.
Yeah, we'd have to. It'd be, RT would be embarrassed of us, but.
You're implying that he isn't already embarrassed.
That's true. Although, you know, he did excitedly tweet that we had a new episode.
He did, yeah. That was very, very nice.
Sorry, I was kind of bringing the mood down there. But
no, I mean, you know, it's...
Let's talk about death instead.
Let's talk about... let's see. We talked about the play. We talked about the pitch session. We have a little list. We always have a little list. We could just move on. No transition needed. Just
you need a transition.
Fuck transitions. Yeah. Reunion.
Who has two thumbs and doesn't need a transition?
These guys. Oh, wait, that's four thumbs.
Damn it. Three after that mishap in the mines.
In the mine. Yeah, you're right. It's been gone 12 hours now, and I'm still not used to
you
it.
You put that like on ice, right?
Was I supposed to?
Yeah.
I thought, you know, salt would do the same
thing. They can't reattach the dead thumb.
Well, but I thought, you know, salt was a preservative before the ice was readily available. So, like, you know, put the thumb in the salt.
That implies that you're going to, like, hang the thumb up, you know, somewhere in, like, a dry cave and let it cure for months.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that might be a useful... I mean, as long as the thumb was still relatively useful... You know, and then in a pinch, it was beef jerky right there on your hand.
I mean, fair enough.
You know.
Fair enough. So, all right. Speaking of stuff that we should do but don't. So, we kind of touched on it a little bit last time. The Geek Force 5 is dead.
Yes.
Your post said, or on hiatus.
Yeah, it's dead.
So... What's going to happen with that?
You know, with the website itself, I have no idea. Every once in a while, something will occur to me. You know, some website where you vote on the top five this or the top five that. Or maybe it'll be a video podcast or a podcast of five people hanging out together doing something. And I'm like, I already have a podcast. I like my podcast. Maybe it'll be... Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Maybe it'll be this, maybe it'll be that. I don't know. All I know is that I felt like I had so many other things on my plate, and there wasn't a differentiating factor for it from all of the hundreds of other pop culture websites out there. So I just was kind of like, you know, I want to focus on the writing, and that's what I've always wanted to focus on. So let's do that. So, I mean, my efforts the last few months haven't been a lot, but I have been thinking about what the next website looks like, and it's at echristopherclark.com is where it'll be. And I'm kind of imagining a website for a writer that is as useful for that writer's fans and readers as a musician's website is. I mean, I think about Amanda Palmer, I think about Trent Reznor, I think about these musicians and then filmmakers to boot, who have these amazing websites where you can get into their work, you can do all sorts of crazy things, and there aren't a lot of great writer websites, and that's kind of where I'm going. I'm still toying with exactly how it'll look. There'll be a paid section for sure. I do want to try to make some money off of what I've been doing for all these years, and I don't want to put ads on it.
Right.
I think that's one of those things that occurred to me in terms of as Geek Force 5 went on, that I don't like ads. I think you can put one on there, as a number of people do that I follow. They use a system called the DEC, where they have one very targeted ad specifically made for people who read their kind of sites. So one or two carefully placed ads can be fine, but it's kind of a veiled way of saying I want to make money at this.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I'd rather just be upfront about, like, hey, if you want to support what I do, pay 99 cents a month and get a couple of stories from me, pay a couple bucks a month and get access to my entire archives.
Right.
You know, let's just be upfront about it. And if not a lot of people do it, fine, you know, but it's there as an option.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I hear you. I mean, I get all kinds of mail about my site, and you know, I do get non-spam, you know, type things where people are just like, hey, you know, we advertise on these music blogs, blah, 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 blah. Mm. You know, do you want to make X amount of, you know, money or whatever? And, you know, I'm always like, well, thanks for the interest, but there are no ads right now, and I kind of like that. So,
yeah. You
know, but it is expensive to, you know, to host and run these things. And
right.
It's, you know, it's tricky to kind of, you know, say, well, where's the line? I mean, there's a blog I like, T-Sides, which, you know, has like a donate button at the bottom, mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, if you like what we do, you know, PayPal, whatever.
Right.
Which I sometimes think about. I think I would have to actually be more steadily producing content for me to feel good putting that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a tough line. I feel the way you do about ads though. I think maybe it's just because, you know, I was there when the web began, mm-hmm. and, you know, I've seen my share of dancing monkeys, and I'm done now.
Yeah.
You know.
And I mean, the honest to God thing is I'm writing for people like me, but also the general populace. And I think most people don't even pay any attention to those ads anymore. I mean, sidebar ads, Google AdSense ads, I just don't think they...
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't run ad block in their browser? You know?
Yeah. If you don't run ad block, I think people have just visually been able to tune those things out.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a matter of actually having to, you know, put some work into what you're doing and making what you're doing valuable enough that people want to pay you for it, rather than hoping that they'll click on some dumb little graphic in the side of your site and that the referral for that will make you some money. Like, I, you know, whatever. I mean, I can see things like Amazon affiliates and things like that, but even that seems kind of violates some part of my soul at this point, because if I want to sell a book, If I want to suggest a book, I'd much rather suggest go to River Run Bookstore in Portsmouth, you know, like,
yeah, I mean, somebody
local. You know, if you're in Henniker, go to that. I mean, they're going to have older books, the bookstore that you and I've been to a couple times. But, you know, support your local bookstore. And I know there are things like IndieBound and whatever.
Yeah, I feel that way, too. Like, I mean, when I link to, you know, you can buy this album here or whatever. Like, usually I try real hard to link to the actual label, you know, or, you know, I suggest some good indie chains that are, you know, on as well, like Criminal Records or Amoeba or whatever. Plus, I mean, I guess there's the line, like, if I were to make money off of my blog, then I would have to change the way I talked about things. Like, I try to be very ethical and say, you know, this person sent this to me or this person recommended this thing. Because I just feel like being upfront about it, you know, like, one, I don't want to pretend that, like, I'm the greatest source of information in the universe. And of course I already knew who these people were, you know. But otherwise, you know, also I think there's an issue of fairness. But I know that there are all these quirky rules now where if somebody sends you something to review, you have to say that in your blog review in some states. I don't know if it's a national thing, but I know that there are some states where there are reporting laws for blogging, which are the same as regular journalism, which strikes me as a bit weird. I'm trying to think of the case, but there was a case where someone actually got in trouble for not being forthcoming about the fact that technology companies were giving them stuff to review.
Yeah, it's a big problem. It was especially a problem, I think, the FTC got involved because of the so-called mommy bloggers.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm thinking of.
And they were getting kickbacks from these companies that they were talking about and not disclosing that they were doing that. And that was that became a whole thing on the bottom of Geek Force 5 posts where I felt like I had to include a disclaimer saying, okay, these things are Amazon affiliate links and these things are this. And it was just like, I like a clean web page design to begin with, so every little stupid thing I have to add on there ends up driving me insane.
And I mean, you know, the thing is about the stupid mommy blogging thing is that it's unethical, but I'm not sure it's illegal. I mean, your used car salesman is going to tell you that the car you're looking at is the best car ever.
Right.
But he's making a commission, you know, and that's probably not his real opinion.
Yeah. Fair point. Yeah.
I mean, not that I'm that sort of person. I like I said, I like to be upfront about stuff, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, it's a very different model than I'm imagining for this E. Christopher Clarke website as opposed to what GeekForce was. I imagine that there'll still be a blog component to it because there are ideas that kick up once every week, once every couple of weeks, where I'd really like to talk about this or really like to talk about that aspect of storytelling somewhere. And oh God, don't even get me started on storytelling. I feel like my favorite term for what I do has been co-opted by marketing Twitter people at this point. You know, my tagline has been passionate about storytelling in all its forms, and now I think that makes me sound like a sleazy marketer and I have to change it.
No, more like a pretentious douche.
Well, I'm okay with being a pretentious douche, but sleazy marketer, not so much.
Yeah, it's tough, right? I mean, certain words become so ingrained in certain strata of advertising copy, and it takes a while for it to go away. Like, you know, of course, so many literary things these days are about narrative. And you know, and narrative in this and narrative in that. And at a certain point you have to be like, for fuck's sake, everything that is written has a narrative.
Right.
You know, can we please maybe refine the term just a little bit?
Just a little.
But yeah, you know, having been to MLA in January, I got really tired of like people shoehorning the word narrative into these discussions about completely unrelated things. Because that's the buzzword. And it's the same with the digital humanities that I work in as well. You know, like people go way out of their way to fit the word digital humanities into their title.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's a whole other bit of marketing, right? Trying to get your panel or your paper accepted.
Yeah.
You got to throw the buzzwords in there just to get in.
It's pretty sad, but now I feel for you. I do. I mean, it's annoying.
But I think you have a point that it is by words like storytelling, words like narrative are not all that descriptive. So the revised tagline I've been thinking about is something along the lines of author, playwright, performer, which are, you know, still author is a little bit vague, but I have one novel and it's not published, and I also write short stories, so saying novelist doesn't feel right.
Well, I mean, I feel like, you know, you have, yeah, I mean, like, you reach a point where you have two choices, right? Like, you can either say, okay, well, you know, these kids have thoroughly peed in my pool, so I'm going to do something else. Or, you know, you have an opportunity to be like, well, a lot of people use the word storytelling, but let's talk about what it really is and to kind of, like, champion it and take it back.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's tough either way, because one way it's kind of frustrating to have to change what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you know, there's the signal to noise ratio of the one sane person in the, you know, thunderstorm.
Right.
But
yeah, well, I mean, but revising this tagline, as I'm referring to it, has been an unintended benefit or unintended something. Result of that is that it did make me think this month, and RT is going to be bummed to hear me say this, but it did make me think this month about what my priorities are. I like creating music, and part of what fell under that storytelling of all forms umbrella was music, was Pop Bubblegum Trash, and I did that album last year, and I had some ideas for what I do for this year's RPM Challenge, which takes place every February. But I stepped back and I said, you know, I can't have five priorities. I probably shouldn't even have three priorities. If it's a priority, there's one of them, maybe two. So, you know, playwriting and fiction writing in terms of my creative output have to be my priorities. That's where I'm getting finally some traction. And so, you know, I still like making music, and I think I'll continue to make music for fun, but I don't think that'll be the primary focus. And so, yeah, an unintended result of this whole thing is, okay, I'm gonna narrow it down to author and playwright, and then performer I'll throw in there because sometimes I act, sometimes I do this or that. And
well, and I mean, you know, not to be, you know, too punsy about it, but storytelling is performative as well. Mm. So, I mean, there is that as well. So,
yeah. So, anyway, so, I mean, I think, you know, that's what's going on with my websites. What about what you've got planned?
I sort of kicked the tires yesterday, you know, trying to get back into the swing of things. I posted a bunch of news articles, and that felt good. You know, it felt good. I've got a ton of music reviews to do. And I'm really, you know, the trouble is I'm trying to think, like, okay, what's a reasonable rate to put them out? Like, I went through my enormous backlog of email. I weeded out all kinds of crap.
Yeah.
There was some crap. There was some great stuff too, but there were some things where you were just like, wow. did you guys raid our old high school basement tapes? What the hell? I remember Satin. It sounded kind of like this.
Yeah.
That song will never make it out. I don't know who I'd have to kill if it got out, but it would be...
Probably Kyle Kidd. He was part of that, wasn't he?
There would be blood. Yeah, so, you know, okay, so basically now I've identified I've got about 108 albums that I want to post about, or just bands in general that I want to do a longer post about.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a lot.
And you know, I want to do it quickly because some of these have been sitting there for 3 months, which is pretty embarrassing, or even longer in a couple of cases. And, you know, the thing is, how many posts can you reasonably put out at a time? You know,
yeah.
I mean, okay, fine. Apparently, according to, you know, Twitter, nobody reads RSS feeds anymore, even though they're super convenient and they make a hell of a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. There's even been some discussion in popular blogging software circles of, like, dropping the feed from the blog. It's like, guys, no. We had these because we couldn't get people to come to our blogs every day to see our fresh content. There was a reason for this. Okay, so setting aside the issue of, you know, the feed, it's just a matter of, like, I only have so much real estate on my front page.
Right.
You know, and I do have a featured post section, but how many posts can you reasonably put out in a short period of time and not just lose people's attention? You know, and I know that for a while in Geekverse 5, you were trying to do 5 a day because...
Yeah,
you know,
and it was...
And that's a lot. It's a lot of content to have to produce, but it's also... You reach a point where it's like, how do you space them out? How do you, you know, how do you not give short shrift to the one that you just posted because you just pushed it off the front page?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. So I don't know. Any thoughts? I'm trying really hard to come up with a way of doing that without taking half a year to spread.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's where I don't know. I mean, when you've got 100 something to get through,
I mean, 2 a day for 2 months seems reasonable, but then some people are waiting a really long time.
Yeah, but I mean, I think anything more than that starts to be too much for the reader. I mean, I to give you an example, so in terms of popular sites from a couple of different genres, I guess,
right,
that I read Deuce.com, which is Heather Armstrong, one of the so-called mommy bloggers, I suppose, although she's been around far longer than she's been a mother, famous for losing her job because of her blog way back when, has a few different short posts per day, usually photo-related, and then maybe one big post a day. John Gruber, who runs Daring Fireball, which is a mostly Mac-focused technology blog, if he does a longer post, it's usually one a day, but sometimes it's only a couple times a week that he does a longer post. A lot of his are more link based and maybe maybe have a little bit of content, but aren't something that you call full length.
I mean, that's something I was thinking about, actually, was that, you know, now that my site has this kind of magazine layout and I can add different sections, you know, I know that my friend, sort of friend, we're friendly acquaintances online.
Yeah.
Sandy, who runs Slow Acoustic and Yearbird Records, he has this thing he started doing for a while on Saturdays. He was putting like the Saturday, you know, roundup, and it was like very short things that had accumulated over the week. I started doing this with a things I should have mentioned section,
right?
Which, you know, was hit or miss. But, you know, now he started doing a song of the day kind of thing. And, you know, it's just, you know, there'll be a short description and then a link or a video. Yeah. And then there you go. And I started thinking, like, you know, of those 100 odd things, there's probably about 40 of them, which are, I liked them. But I don't have anything really insightful to say, you know, I just, this is good and it exists. And sometimes I actually, the thing that holds up posting on my blog, and I'm sure this happens to you sometimes, is it's like, okay, I know I want to post about this, but I don't really have anything that feels review-y enough. So I'm going to sit on it until I've got enough stuff I can make up to fill, you know, a 300 word post and feel good about it.
Yeah. No, I definitely had that with Geekverse. There were things I sat on for a while, and then they weren't timely. And
So I kind of feel like I might do something similar and just come up with it. You know, the stuff for a rainy day section was supposed to be that. It was supposed to be like, here's a band that exists and they're good and go listen to them. But you know, maybe that's something I need to embrace more with the site.
I mean, I think it's probably, based on the amount of submissions that you're getting, probably one of the only ways to maintain sanity is to have a couple of different buckets that things go into. This is the bucket of, I definitely have a few paragraphs to say on this, and this is the bucket of, here's a video and a link to their website. And I think...
You know, I guess that's something not to shy away from either, because, you know, Stereogum and Pitchfork do that, and they're quite successful, so...
Yeah. And I mean, I think any band that gets that kind of treatment is going to be just as happy about that as they're going to be about a review. And obviously, I mean, we're all of us artists are a little bit egotistical and love to see, you know, a good 5-paragraph essay on how awesome we are. But, you know, that's a link in a video is sometimes good, too.
Right. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, maybe it's something I'll experiment with. I don't know. So yeah, kind of, slowly getting back up to speed. It was really heartwarming yesterday. I put up those few posts, and a few hours later, I went to check the stats, and the traffic came back, and I was
Yeah.
like, "Aw, they're still out there.
See,
Hooray!"
that's awesome, because that's the one thing that I worry about when it comes to launching a new site is it's all about me. It's all about my work, this thing that I'm talking about, and it's
Yeah. Well, hopefully you can get some naked pictures on it. Not of you,
yeah,
but
yeah, no, naked pictures would be all right. I have thought about, let me throw this out at you, because one of the things I've
starting a porn site?
no, but pictures.
Huh.
I'm a fiction writer, and I have occasionally done comic book work before, and I actually have a comic book series that's on hold, that I mean to get back to someday. But so I appreciate how pictures and words pair up. But one thing that I've been struggling with is this idea that I would like to include some sort of visual representation of character
Right.
on the maybe in a sort of wiki form on the new website. And one thing I can't decide about is whether or not that's a good idea, because if I give the reader of a piece of textual fiction a photograph or a drawing of what I imagine the character to be like, that's robbing them of a little bit of their part of the experience
Right.
of reading a piece. But there's this part of me that says, I have great photographer friends. I have actors slash who would be perfect as sort of models just for still shoots to get a definitive look for a character. So there's part of me that thinks, oh, that sounds like a really neat idea, but then the traditional fiction writer and reader in me does not want to, does not want to have happen what happened for me with the Harry Potter series, for instance, where I came to it late, and by the time I came to the Harry Potter books, I had already seen photographs of Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter from the then forthcoming movie series. So I never got to read Harry Potter without Daniel Radcliffe's image in my brain.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I like the idea, but on the other hand, I'm writing traditional fiction, not a graphic novel. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's tricky. I know some people who combine the visual and the literary really well. I sent you a link. There's a blog. My friend Gigi, she's a professor. She is a poet. She's won some poetry awards, and she runs a blog called The Magpie's Pen, which people could Google. It has a companion blog, The Magpie's Fancy, which is about her life as well, which is also quite interesting. And she's a photographer as well, and she takes a lot of photos to accompany her poems or to accompany her stories. And she does this, in ways that are quite affecting and very successful. And I think maybe perhaps, and I know I have poetry friends who will be irritated about this, but poetry is a medium which kind of lends itself to a more visual pairing in a way that, yeah, there is a lot of anxiety, as you say, when you write fiction that you don't want to straitjacket the interpretation. Although, okay, yeah, that sounds unfair to poetry,
No,
but.
but I know what you're saying. I don't know if you remember my old E. Christopher Clarke site, prior to putting out the second collection of short stories, All He Left Behind. I did pair up pieces of stories with visual representations of them. Often they were inanimate objects. If they were people, sometimes, for instance, in one case, it was two pairs of, it was a man and a woman standing next to each other wearing identical blue jeans and identical red chucks, like where you got the feel of something. And I just took a peek at your friend's website, and she seems to do something similar where you get a feel for people. If there are people in the photo, it's not, a close up on their face. There's one on this front page where there's a, person who you can definitely identify, but there's a great one of somebody diving off a rock into the water. Things like that are probably A-OK.
Yeah, and I mean, that's certainly something I think you can put in kind of a blogging section where you're like, you know, when I conceive of this or when I think of this, you know, this is something that comes to mind or I have a strong memory, you know, certainly because so much of what you're talking about has to do with the Cape or, you know, these kind of specific places.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually really helpful to to a reader. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, wow, Generation Kids got in a weird direction today. but that's okay. I mean, I think about the form of the novel as we know it now and the way that we're used to consuming content. I think, you know, anybody under 40, you know, we're used to a rich media environment, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that everybody's primary reading source is the web. I would go out on a limb and say, I think that probably the majority of text that we encounter in a year is web-based text.
Yeah.
At least in the so-called first world and probably in a lot of the rest of the world. I mean, there's 2 billion people online, I think was the statistic I saw this week. So, you know, it's okay. So, you know, given that, I mean, I'm not used to encountering text on the web that's just naked text. In fact, when I do, my brain subconsciously, you know, alerts me that this is old. And this is kind of stale content. And, you know, that's stupid, but then you think about the novel, right? And you think about, okay, well, in the 18th century, novels were usually epistolatory, right? They were written in the style of letters going back and forth or, you know, kind of compilations of shorter text.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we get the ridiculous long-form novel in the 19th century and serialized novel, and we get what we have now, which is, you know, a large paper collection of static text, which I still have a romantic feeling for and I love, and I, you know, my work involves manuscripts and codices and all kinds of wonderful dead things.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's so much potential, there's so much possibility in a text. And I think that, you know, looking for ways to combine those sorts of visual things that you're talking about, you know, it, I think it's something we need to do more of, you know, because I think it's not about, you know, saying, oh, the novel's dead. It's more about just saying, well, as consumers of content, you know, what do we really expect? And I think that when you can meet those generic expectations of a text, you'll be more successful. So I'm not sure how we started that, but
I mean, I think we've been talking about websites and we just got into, you know, what I'm planning to do with mine. And I think what I'm looking to do with my website is, and I don't think I'm flattering myself when I say that, I think it's kind of a unique proposition at this point. I think there are probably many, many people out there, writers out there, trying to do the same thing right now. It's just going to be, you know, who does it really well first.
Or maybe you need to band together with some of them, you know, and maybe perhaps John Herman style collaborate on. I mean, it would be interesting also to see a website with active collaboration between authors, you know, in a kind of way that we could kind of spectate on, you know, which
I have often one of my and of course, if I say this out loud, somebody's going to steal it from me. Right. And,
yeah, it's true. Our readership is vast.
Yeah.
Our audience rather.
I have toyed with this idea for many, many years of a either a wiki-based novel, a wiki-based story where everyone collaborates to this thing, something along the lines of Wikipedia or one of these things where it's a wiki for a story that never really existed, but everyone just comes in and contributes and starts writing about this aspect of the world or this aspect of the world. And I thought that would be cool at one point. At one point, I toyed with the idea because so much of my work, as you said, takes place either in down the Cape or in Chelmsford, I toyed with the idea of a web-based narrative, collaborative narrative that would involve many people writing their or telling their perspectives on the town we grew up in. I've toyed with the idea a whole bunch. I just haven't found the time to do anything about it.
Yeah. I don't know. So maybe, just to kind of whet our appetites at some point, we should do a Generation Goat, Goat's history of Chumsword and go draw it around or something.
That would be a good one. I mean, I think we're talking about you and I have exchanged back and forth some ideas of how we're gonna keep having enough content for a weekly podcast, and that would be a good one because I think there are things that don't occur to us, I think, in conversation except when you are driving through place.
That's true.
Is one of the things. I mean, place is a really important thing for me as a writer, and it's one of the things I focus on really heavily in the classroom when I'm talking about fiction. And I think place has an effect on memory. There are things that you and I have talked about driving through Chelmsford that I'll be like, damn, we haven't had that memory or that conversation in years. Just randomly coming back. I think there was one time, probably, I was going to say a few years ago, might have been a decade ago at this point, where coming back after like New Year's Eve in Boston or Cambridge, we were driving through Chelmsford or Carlisle or something. I don't remember in particular what we were talking about, but I remember being like, man, I haven't thought about this stuff in a really long time.
Speaking of things you haven't thought about in a long time, I saw the crazy guy with the orange hat the other day.
Did you? The story that I have coming out in...
It's about the crazy guy with the orange hat?
Yes.
Oh, right.
Right. So if this anthology comes out this year, which I am told it will, I have a story coming out in... Mill City Stories is the name of the anthology. And it's about the comic book store, and it's about the crazy guy in the orange hat who used to roam around our town.
Yeah, I saw him the other day. He was yelling at a telephone pole.
I feel bad for the guy on one level, but...
He must be doing okay. He's still rocking the orange hat, and he's been going up and down that street for like 2 decades, so...
Yeah. There's an older lady who goes up and down North Road a lot that I have seen. I don't think she's got any sort of difficulties or challenges in the way that he does. But I do see her all the time, and I feel really sad for her because I think at one point I used to see her walk with either husband, partner, or whatever, and he's not around anymore. Yeah, there are stories to be told driving around that town. Of course, the town is not big enough to drive around for an hour, so we might have to...
We used to manage.
Okay. Well, yeah, we used to manage, but there were sometimes pit stops and things. So,
it's true. It's true.
You start off...
We'll go get some slush puppies.
We'll start off at the high school. We'll be weird people, and then we'll drive around and get slush puppies and... That'll be a good
one. Will's house, blast debaser, realize he lives in a different state and is not.
Yeah. Debaser, we'll at least know what theme song we're going to use going into that one.
It's true. We can actually just have music under the podcast by just playing it in the car. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is.
Sorry, listener, you're riveted for sure.
No, hey, you know what? I think our podcast is what our podcast is. And we don't need to be embarrassed about it.
Fair enough. I don't know. It feels like kind of a place to kind of wrap up a little
bit.
Yeah,
for sure.
Wow, 2 goats in 2 weeks.
2 goats in 2 weeks. I did look back and was it in the archives? One in February 2009, two for March, one for April, one for May, one for June, one for September. One for January. I mean,
there are no months in between those.
Oh, August 2010. Oh, that was probably because of PodCamp. There's four in August 2010.
Ha!
Suck
on that.
You know what? Two of them are actually podcasts. One of them is just a greeting because you had moved over.
All right. Fine,
moved over to the site, and one of them is show notes. So
Jinx and Max are no longer friends.
Yeah.
Oh well.
Anyway. You
know, it's a trend. It's a first.
It's a trend. And, there are 2 weeks in a row.
Looks like we lived through it, so
we did.
We eternally suck. Even though if I pass my PhD, my name will be Doc Martin.
Yeah. And then you will decidedly not suck. I would love to co-host a podcast with Doc Martin.
You think we'd get sued?
It's spelled differently.
True. All right. Well, that's a goat, I guess. So
I guess.
Presuming we live through the week, we'll see you next time.
Yes, we will.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye. And you're standing on our streets, where Hector was the first of the gang with a gun in his hand, and the first to do time, the first of the gang to die. Such a silly boy, Hector was the first of the gang with a gun in his hand, and the bullets